and welcome to the Blue Rose Cinema Club. I am Charlie, and I'm here with my fantastic co-host.
Hey, it's Crash. How you doing?
Today we are talking about the brevity is the soul of wit, Solaris.
Yes, the briefest of films.
It is a Tarkovsky Russian film that is under 3 hours, and it feels it.
Yeah, it's a scant just under 3 hours. This really is him at his most subdued, I guess.
Stalker is both longer and slower. This one has plot.
Well, that's the funny thing about this film. So Tarkovsky personally believes that it's a failure because it didn't transcend the medium, unlike Stalker. I feel like if that is, you know, if you're going to hate on your own work just because it didn't completely fundamentally change and go beyond the medium you're working on, that's not a failure. Your goals are different.
That sounds accurate for Tarkovsky, though. He was an intense dude.
He certainly was. And this is exactly the kind of film he'd look at and be like, it's all right.
It's not my best work.
I could do better than this. Produced in 1972 by Moss Film, the great Soviet-era industrial complex, you will watch movies and you will clap, comrade. Directed and co-written, of course, by Andrei Tarkovsky, based on Stanislav Lem's novel of the same name. It is starring, here's some names, Donatas Banionis, Natalia Benderchuk, Yari Yarvet, Vladislav Dvorhetsky, Anatoly Solonitsyn, Sargsyan, fucking hell, and Nikolai Grinko.
It's quite a mouthful.
Quite a mouthful. The film follows Soviet scientist Chris Kelvin as he is sent to evaluate a space station and its inhabitants, orbiting above and observing the planet Solaris, a sphere of gleaming golden ocean. Before leaving, he speaks to a former pilot who had previously visited Solaris, who tells him of seeing a forest suddenly grow beneath him and an enormous 4-meter-tall child. Arriving at the station, Kelvin finds that one of the three remaining personnel, Dr. Gilbaran, has killed himself, and his colleagues, Dr. Sartorius and Dr. I can never get his pronunciation right. Such a bad name. Seem unconcerned and disinterested. Kelvin gets glimpses of others on board, though. People who shouldn't and couldn't be on board, like his former wife, Perry, who he unsuccessfully tries to airlock. Eventually accepting the other guests and Harry, Kelvin, Sartorius, and Snot all the same come up with both way to destroy the visitors and to stop them from being created at all, theorizing that Solaris itself is manifesting them from the crew's own memories, and that by broadcasting Kelvin's brainwaves directly to the planet, they can communicate that they'd really rather not, thank you.
Please stop sending my dead wife's ghost. It's a lot.
Really appreciate not having to deal with this. Thank you so much. Following a night of bizarre dreams, Kelvin awakes to find Harry has asked Snot and Sartorius to destroy her, while islands have emerged on the surface of Solaris. The movie ends as it began, with Kelvin at his father's home, but this time it is revealed that it is a manifestation of Solaris. Fuck.
All of that does happen in the film.
Yeah, these are the things that occur that shouldn't take 3 hours, but...
Well, there is the... amazing scene that is just driving around Tokyo to show like a futuristic city.
I love that.
That is in the film only because Tarkovsky and his crew wanted to go to Japan.
Yeah.
They wanted to go for a trip and they got the Russian Film Board to fund it, and to make it seem legit, they filmed some stuff and they put it in the film. It was like, well, it has to go in here because they paid for a trip, but we just wanted to go to Japan.
Right, and instead they've accidentally actually, like, If they didn't create, then they certainly, I feel like, influenced the creation of Cyberpunk. So they visited upscale Akasaka neighborhood in Japan. It's where, if you ever see super rich, super advanced footage from Japan, it's probably from Akasaka. This is where all the tech giants are. This is where all of the ridiculous rich people in Tokyo like to hang out. And this was shot in the late 60s, and it was already a tech capital of the world.
It looks gorgeous. It does look incredible.
It looks amazing. But most importantly, it is the first use of Japan and Japan, Japanese design and architecture to denote the future. And it is the first use of that cyberpunk aesthetic of, despite the rest of the world that we've introduced you to being European, here's a bunch of Japanese advertisements and a bunch of Japanese signs to just get you in the idea that the world that you think this is has moved far beyond into a geopolitical specter that you can't even understand. There's also, at the same time, another kind of precursor to a later aesthetic in sci-fi. This film looks filthy as shit. They intentionally made the Solaris station look just dingy and uncomfortable.
And yeah, it looks like a ship that has not been refurbished or dealt with or repaired in any way. It is just grinding and been left to rot in space.
Right. It looks very much like the Nostromo, which is supposed to be a truck. It's mm-hmm. it's a space truck, and this is supposed to be this grand space station that's out there studying this supposedly alive planet, and it looks like Red Dwarf sets in terms
it
of
does.
Film. Yeah, and this is all coming before before any of those aesthetics really came into sci-fi, and it comes even before the aesthetic of used in grime that was used and typically people believe introduced into science fiction with Star Wars, with the rebellion mm-hmm. being represented by having to use broke down, grimy, filthy, crappy equipment, as opposed to the Empire's sleek and clean and everything new. That very specific element is a direct agenda statement, action statement of the film. So there's a lot, as you say, there's a lot going on thematically when it comes to this film, but there's one big thing that you're supposed to especially take away. This film is the Soviet Union's response to 2001: A Space Odyssey by Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick, in which we are presented with the future of what American consumer space travel is supposed to be. Everything's nice and sleek, and you can buy a ticket to this, and you can ride in comfort into the stars, and the future is just waiting for you to buy in. And this one says, "Fuck you. Everything is filthy, yeah. Everything is trying to kill you, and the problem with humanity isn't what is out in the world, it is you. You yeah. are the thing that we're going to focus on, not the universe.
Humanity will bring its demons with it to the stars."
Exactly, instead of evolving past them and then the stars welcoming us, this entire thing was a direct response to 2001. Very specifically, Tarkovsky said, "We don't need other worlds. We need mirrors. Solaris seeks not to understand humanity's place in the cosmos, but our relationship with the divine and ourselves as ones who drive it instead of the divine driving our activity." It's a really fascinating a juxtaposition to the presumptions of space travel and how we approach it in the West.
Yeah, and it also deals a lot with what is self and who is the person, because with his wife keep coming back, the longer she's there, the more memories from her past she gets, but she also creates new one on the station and starts becoming more and more different because she's now living a new life. And it does have a lot of really fascinating things to say about what makes a person. If you can copy someone exactly, is it them or is it someone similar? It's a very heady film, and true to all of his movies, it's very slow and it takes its time. There's beautiful artistic shots that hold for minutes at a time. It opens with a shot of just reeds moving in the water for quite a while, and it's hypnotic and beautiful, but the very measured pace forces you to kind of start thinking and internalize what's going on, because there's not a lot visually happening, especially not for quite a while. So it forces you to kind of sit in and start thinking, okay, so what are they trying to build and what are they trying to do with this?
Yeah. And it's a film that intentionally creates this sense of claustrophobia that makes you think about your place and what it means and what it's trying to tell you and what you're trying to tell you. And oh my God, is that your voice in your head or someone else's? Oh God. Oh no. This is a film that almost demands that you turn it off midway through and go have a think about what you've done.
Mm-hmm. This is my third of Tartakovsky that I've seen. I've seen this, Stalker, and The Mirror, and it is definitely a recurring theme of his, where it is that same aggressively slow, measured pace that you have to... It does not hold your hand. You really have to work to know what's going on and follow and try and understand both the linear story that's going through and, more importantly, the philosophical undertones.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it's funny. This film is jam-packed. You feel every minute of it. It's a very long film. You feel every minute of it, but it couldn't be cut down.
You couldn't cut anything.
Yeah.
Really, it's all necessary.
Even though, like, as you said, there are entire sections where it's just a single image repeated for about 5 minutes, like the golden shimmering water or the reeds. It just goes on and on and on, but that's intentional. And it just makes it funny that Stanislav Lem, the writer of the novel, doesn't actually like this book because he feels like... Tarkovsky took all the actual guts of it and hollowed it out. So the writer of the novel believes that this film is shallow.
Like, it's shallow if you weren't paying attention, sure.
I think it's and the reason it's shallow, or rather the reason he believes it's shallow, is really fascinating, and again has to do with who created it. So apparently there was a much larger version of the script, and it was like Tarkovsky and Lem worked hard on it. Tarkovsky worked with a bunch of other people to try and make sure it was great. It had everything. It was the perfect script for the film, and the Soviet censors looked at it and went, "You have to remove every reference to religion in a film that is based on a book that is mostly about religion."
Yeah, the entire film is very much heavily implying that it is meeting God or a God.
Yeah. By like stripping the overtness out of it, I feel like it made it smarter. Like if he had just actually made an argument on behalf of the religious aspect of this, it probably wouldn't have come off as smart.
Yeah, I think it does work a lot better because depending on what your religion or faith is, or if you don't have any, it's still, you can find something that will mirror the experiences in this. You will learn something about if the planet could be consciousness. It doesn't have to be God. It could be trying to come to grips with your place in the universe or your concept of what is yourself compared to someone else. It doesn't have to be religious. It very strongly implies religion at different points, but it really does leave it open to interpretation, which I think is one of the stronger points of the film. Is there's so much going on and so much of it is left ambiguous that you, the audience, can bring so much to it.
And that's kind of the funniest thing is that the film is about self-examination. And if it had left in those themes, you wouldn't have that to self-examine.
Yeah, it makes you question yourself, which is what it's a it is a fantastic film. It is a hard one to recommend. It is very hard to be like, you should check this out. It is nearly 3 hours. It is painfully slow, and it is half Russian philosophy and half sort of sci-fi.
Yeah, sort of sci-fi. Like this is possibly the greatest episode of Doctor Who that the Doctor doesn't appear in, like classic Doctor Who, that the Doctor doesn't appear in. And I mean that both in terms of its attempt at heady thought and philosophy and its reality of dirt cheap sets.
Like, yeah, the sets are fantastic, and they really, really look like cheaply knocked together. Like, have you ever seen, I think it's Dark Star?
Oh, I love Dark Star.
Did the set not like look a little bit like Dark Star? I kind of expected a ball to just bounce down a hallway.
From what I've read, the sets in Dark Star were somewhat based on this, which means, of course, that yes, the sets in Alien are based somewhat on this. So there's a very intentional and clear line from this film to Red Dwarf. Red Dwarf was influenced by Alien by Dark Star by this.
I would also throw out, there is a line, Event Horizon definitely has some nods of when he first arrives at the ship, and the people who, like, one's killed himself, the other two are clearly insane, and the ship is weird. There's stuff that shouldn't be there all over the place, and it's just him wandering around going like, what the fuck happened here? It very much had that same type of something bad happened here and I have to figure out what.
Yeah, there's a fantastic approach to this where you could say it's just on the verge of being truly good cosmic horror, but instead of revealing itself to be horror, it just kind of goes, whatever, man.
It's very Russian. The true horror is yourself.
Yeah. If you're okay with it, it'll be okay. If you have any level of self-reflection, your soul will burn. And
if you have any self-doubts, this film will hurt you.
Yes, it will. But it's funny that most people have never heard of this film. If they have, they've heard of the George Clooney remake from a few years ago. But it premiered...
A few years ago? Wasn't that...
10 years ago, 15. Nice.
I have not seen it. I've heard it's okay.
It's all right, but that's the thing. Like, this is a film that...
It is 20 years ago, actually, because it was from 2002, so 19 years ago.
This is a film that, like, influenced a lot of things people have seen, but people haven't necessarily seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is it premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in 1972. It won the Grand Prix Special de Jury. It played for 15 years solid until the fall of the Soviet Union. Like,
wow.
This movie should be better known. It got immediate accolades. People immediately understood and respected it. And it just
probably his most famous internationally as well. Like, I would think it's the one that got the most crossover views, because it is his most accessible as well. We're talking about how inaccessible this film is, but it is easily his most accessible that I've seen.
It absolutely is. It's very straightforward, and it very much tells you, okay, sit down, we're going to have a scene where we talk about thought.
Yeah. If you're on board with that, that's the next 10 minutes. When that's over, we'll go into the next plot piece.
There you go. But yeah, like, well deserving of its place in the Criterion Collection, which to juxtapose with the previous episode we did talking about Chasing Amy, a film that many people would say, why the hell is it in the Criterion Collection? That film went direct from theater to Criterion. This film, which again, Grand Prix winner at the Cannes Film Festival, it didn't get Criterion until 2011.
It is number 164 on the spine. So it's top. Look, I didn't pick the first few episodes on ones I actually had on Blu-ray. I swear that is not the reason we picked the first few films, except it mostly is.
Mostly is. But like, that blows my mind that this is so clearly a brilliant film, and it just kind of like incidentally got included eventually.
Yeah, I think they definitely knew the importance, especially when they started broadening the scope to include more and more foreign and films. If you're talking about Russian cinema that's influential, this is easily a major cornerstone.
Yeah, and I'm done talking about Potemkin. We've done Potemkin.
Yeah, he's important and he's great and he's good, but like for the 70s, this film definitely influenced so much, and a lot of it in subtle ways too, where it was just maybe not a direct reference because it's hard to directly reference a 3-hour slow philosophical film, but they took elements.
Yeah, and I just cannot, I personally can't accept that at some point someone like William Gibson didn't see this film and then 10 years write elements of it into like Neuromancer.
Yeah, it's the type of film that seeps into, like, no pun intended, seeps into your subconscious. It's because of so much is happening and they're so philosophical that it really gets under your skin.
Yeah, it's
like, when I first watched it, I was like, oh, this is great. And then 2 days later, it was like, huh, I'm still thinking about different parts of this that I didn't even really notice while I was watching it.
Yeah, it's a truly great film where you're, as you say, you're still thinking of it days later, and not because you're the way that, you know, sometimes you'll think about modern films days later going like, wow, they really did make that bad decision. I've been thinking about this for the last 3 days and that scene is not getting better.
Yeah, it's still a terrible choice. Why did they do that? This one, there's very few bad choices in this. There's a few dodgy effects, and there's one scene where he hides from a rocket taking off by hiding behind a chest-high wall and puts a coat over him.
Listen, you'd be surprised how often that has worked for me. NASA has no idea where I am.
You have a really... It was a little bit hiding in the fridge for Indiana Jones, I thought. It was a bit that slightly too, okay, I know why you're doing it, and I know we're not being completely scientifically accurate because none of this film has been. That is a slight step too far.
Just a little silly. But like, again, in the correct level of where it kind of was operating in terms of time. And that's why I like to think of it as the greatest Doctor Who episode, because that's great Doctor Who logic of like, duck behind this wall. Okay, the future aliens didn't see us. We're fine.
Yeah, the my coat will protect me from flame. So have you heard when Akira Kurosawa got Tarkovsky wasted?
No. What?
So Kurosawa was visiting Mosk Film to see the production company. He was in Russia. He was looking to see where he's going to set up his next production. While he was interviewing with the head, he heard a huge explosion off near where they were, and he looked panicked, and the studio head said, no, it's not a war. That's just Tarkovsky shooting a rocket. So then he was like, can I meet him? So they went and met, and they introduced him, and Kurosawa invited Tarkovsky out for a drink. He said, let's go have a drink. Tarkovsky didn't really drink at this time, and Kurosawa was a raging alcoholic. And so they got him they started doing shots of vodka, as you do, you're in Russia, or the USSR at this point. And Tarkovsky got wasted, stood up on the table, and started loudly singing the Seven Samurai theme. And Kurosawa joined in and sang along with him.
That's like, beautiful.
If I had a time machine, going to that bar would be one of the like top five things, just so I could watch these two legends of the screen get wasted and humming along the theme.
It's like, I don't think I've ever been drunk and screaming the Seven Samurai theme before, level of intoxicated, but I feel like that's a target to get to.
especially if you're with Kurosawa, because like it would be weird unless you're doing the theme to him.
Yeah.
That's what you should do, is get drunkenly sing the theme to a director's like most well-known movie to him. I'm sure it will go over well.
Let's aspire to do that to George Lucas. Let's find George Lucas and just start screaming right in his face and see how he responds.
I don't know, Spielberg with Jurassic Park would be great.
Yeah, but I feel like Spielberg would just be like, yeah, you're right. I did direct.
You're right. I am awesome.
Yeah. Well, that was a lot of fun. Thank you very much for suggesting that. I mean, yeah, I wouldn't say watching it was a lot of fun, but understanding it was.
Yeah, it's a film that it is well worth seeing, and if you go into it with the right mindset of like, okay, this is going to be a slow film, I have to be ready for that, it's highly recommended worth seeing.
Fantastic movie.
And next season we'll do Stalker, and that's this on hard mode.
There we go. Yeah. Next Stalker, not next, because my God, I don't think I could sit through another Tarkovsky.
You need a break.
Yeah. What is next on our line?
What is next? Oh, I think next is Naked and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Oh, dear. Naked and then Fear and Loathing. We are going to have an interesting couple of episodes.
Yeah, we've got some fun films coming up for you.
Well, thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in, watching, listening, however it is. Please like, share, subscribe, and leave us a comment if you would like as well. Email us.
We'd love to hear from you. Yes, please email us. We'd love to hear from you if you liked it. If you didn't like it, we'd also kind of like to hear from you. Please send us an email with any questions, comments. If you think we missed something, if you're listening to this screaming, you idiots, why aren't you talking about this? Tell us what this is, and we will bring it up in a future show.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.